Hello and welcome to Really Cool People, a podcast produced by Switzer Church. I'm your host, Jason Leininger. This is a place to hear stories of really cool people whose stories are incredibly fascinating. The hope is that you will be inspired, encouraged, and challenged through moments of serendipity. In a sermon entitled The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis said, "You and I have never met an ordinary person. You've never met or talked to a mere mortal. It's my joy over the next few moments to introduce you to someone who on the outside may seem ordinary, and yet they are a really cool person." Today, we are going to meet Florence Anang. I met Florence in 2014 when Switzer at that time in its life was asking the question, how can we make a better impact in our community impact ministries? And we were being coached by Rudy Carrasco, who had worked with Florence in Pasadena, California. As I was getting ready to lead a group of people to take a look at some ministries, Rudy said, "You need to meet my friend Florence." And Florence has been indeed a coach. She's shared a lot of insight, and she's become a dear friend and someone who Switzer has partnered with in some of the work she's doing in Pasadena. And as we listen to Florence, we'll discover that she was born in Ghana, raised in Great Britain, and now she lives and works and really thrives in Pasadena. So it's a joy to introduce you to my friend, Florence Anang. Today, it is our great joy to welcome Florence Anang to the podcast. And Florence, why don't you begin by telling us about yourself?
Hi, everybody. My name is Florence Anang. I'm born in Ghana, raised in England, and what some people would call a reverse missionary in the United States, in Pasadena, California. I have an after-school and summer camp in community arms, a low-income housing, predominantly African-American and Hispanic. And this will be 2024, my 11th year. And that's my introduction.
That's a very brief introduction for the fullness of your life, Florence. That's great. That is a summary. I've heard that summary of you many times. Why don't you share with us some things about your childhood, about what does it look like to grow up in Ghana or to be born in Ghana?
I was born in Takoradi, which is on by the sea, and most people know it as the Elmino Castles, which is where the slaves, when they were captured from inland, would be taken, and they would be put into the castles, piled on top of each other. And on top of it, which you can still see today, is a church. And it was the Dutch Reformed Church. And they were one of the leaders in the slave trade, and they would have church every Sunday. But underneath them, there were slaves who were, you know, gasping for life, dying, but knowing that they may never return to their homeland. And that's where you will find the door of no return, which is like some people say a window, but it's a door. And once the slaves passed through the door, there was no return. They were going on to the ships. And like I said, Takoradi is, you know, a small village, but if you go there now, it's a bustling community. It's very forward thinking. It's lively. It's beautiful. It's everything. It's a tourist destination. But, you know, if you go deeper in, it's a village. It's, you know, women are cooking. Women are selling. They're the first entrepreneurs in the village early in the morning, and they're coming back to take care of their houses. And that's basically where I grew up.
How old were you when you left
Between Takoradi? 4 and 5, we came to England. But every summer, I came back to Ghana, because my parents wanted me to have the culture ingrained. So, you know, yes, I was in England, but every summer we returned back to Ghana to spend my summers there.
When you say your parents wanted you to have the culture ingrained, what were some of the things about the culture that they hoped that you would pick up on or that you would lean into that would be reflected in who you were to become?
I think community, the food, the traditions, the griots. The griots are, some people would say, like the modern day poets, but, you know, there wasn't so much writing. So griots would hold the history in their minds and tell people who belonged to whose village, you know, for generation to generation to generation. All of those things, they just wanted me to know that I was Ghanaian first, but raised, you know, in a different country.
When you reflect back on that time and you think about the place where you're at now, how does Ghana show up in your leadership in the places where you're living in Pasadena and in the work that you're a part of in Pasadena? How does Ghana get reflected through that prism?
I think it's about community. I think the solutions are in community. The tension is in community. But moreover, the answers have to be found in community. And that's kind of where Ghana shows up. It's a, you know, if you, doesn't matter what technology, doesn't matter what is going on, but you're just a conversation away from an argument or a great, you know, healing. And that's something you just have to navigate. And that's something that, you know, going back home made me realize that you bring community wherever you are, good, bad, or indifferent. And you just have to take responsibility and accountability of the part you play in community.
Yeah. You mentioned when you were describing Takoradi that the place where the slaves would make their departure, on top of that place, there was a Dutch Reformed church. I wonder how did that image of that church shape your understanding of your early understanding of God or your spiritual formation?
Personally, kind of not a lot. And it sounds crazy. There should be anger. There should be all of these things. But basically, you don't know what you don't know. They thought that they were right. They thought that God was on their side. They thought that, you know, because they dominated a country at a specific time and they could rule over people, that, like you say, God was in it. And so I think that you can't capture yourself in that, as a community, in that anger or that unknowing. You have to capture yourself with, now, you know, now they know that it's wrong. Now they know, you know, that it wasn't about God. It was about man's greed, man's evilness, man's, you know, doing what man does at times where they can have power. And so it wasn't about God. You know, you can see that in the Bible all the time. You know, God can stand back and let man do what he's going to do, but in the end of the day, he's going to say, that wasn't right. You didn't need to do all of that. And so I don't think it shaped me. I think it made me just understand that, you know, we serve a God whose grace for us is just overwhelming.
Indeed. So your parents decided to move to England when you were 4 or 5. And do you know what was in the background of their decision in that to make that move?
At the time, it was very simple. England wanted workers from the colonization countries that they had. There were certain jobs that English people just didn't want to do, which was to their detriment. you know, later on. But at the time, they didn't want to be bus drivers. They didn't want to do certain jobs. And so England reached out to the colonies, and, you know, Ghana was an English country. And so my parents, you know, came over to work. But the difference is that they came to, you know, a lot of Africans or West Indian people came to work, but it was never about staying. It was always about, you know, getting the work and then kind of building a home back home and going back home. So you either had some people who had homes in England and homes back home. So they were always returning because it wasn't the end destination.
How long did you end up living in England then?
Basically elementary, high school, a little bit of college. And then after that, it was just more just traveling and just seeing the world and seeing it for what it is, and having friends over here and family. And so, yeah.
There's a question I like to ask lots of different folks, and it's always interesting. I wonder if you could share what your fourth grade year was like.
Fourth grade?
Yeah.
It was fine. I went to like literally an all white school. So there was probably less than 10 black kids in the school. It was fine. I can't really, you know, the teachers, everything about it, because when you come from African parents or African culture, it's about the education. So, you know, you don't go to school to make friends. You go to school to learn. Yeah, it was my fourth grade was my fourth, fifth, sixth. I think for whatever reason, I was able to move through school and I didn't have the stories of racism. I didn't have any of those things at all, or none that I can remember. But yeah, it was really, it was moreover, it was about school. It was about school. It's about grades. It's about, you know, when you walked back into my home, it was like mini Ghana. You know, my parents weren't the parents who were westernized. They were definitely, you know, Ghanaian, the food, the culture, the parties, everything. So yeah, it was good.
Huh. That picture, did you ever watch Ted Lasso on Apple TV?
Uh-huh.
That picture reminds me of the experience of Sam, one of the soccer players, and the restaurant that he puts together. Did that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, like I said, you know, England at that time was just getting an influx of Africans and West Indian people from whatever country was colonized. So there was a newness before there was, okay, this is too much. And that took a few more years, you know, many, many more years for them to realize that maybe they should have done those jobs. Maybe they should have whatever. But yeah, it was yeah, I could see the similarity.
Let's turn now to your time in Pasadena. How did you come from, or how did you find your way from England to Pasadena?
I was working for an artist, a music artist called John B, who lived in Pasadena. And so I was going backwards and forwards from England to, you know, Pasadena. And then eventually, you know, his workload was getting heavy. And so decided to, you know, make me the assistant. And that's how kind of I landed in Pasadena.
I've never heard of John B. What kind of music did he produce? Or did he make?
It's basically a young white soul singer. I mean, most people know him from Babyface, Someone to Love, it was a you know, very strong single. And then, you know, he kind of, you know, did really well. And yeah, he did really well.
And then from working with John B, what was your next step?
Well, when I got saved, I just, you know, went into church one day, came out, was just a little bit different. And what you call pearl making was happening. Everything was an irritant to create, you know, a God pearl. And so I was like, it's time. And, you know, I just decided to leave, found a place in Pasadena, and was able to make that home, and was just trying to pray and figure out next steps. And a friend of mine who lived on Navarro, you know, told me to, you know, go and volunteer at Harambe. And I took a minute and then eventually I went down there, and the first person that I met was Rudy and then Derek Perkins.
You want to describe Harambe for the people who listen who won't know anything about it?
Harambe was founded by John Perkins back in the 80s when it was just real drug infested street. And, you know, a gentleman was just, Ray Brown, was just, you know, doing a lot of drugs on that street and in the community. And Mr. Perkins just got hold of the first house on the corner and moved his family in under great resistance, and then just decided to start buying up the block. And when he started to buy up the block, you know, they turned it into, Mrs. Perkins had a good news club, and it was the first after school in the city. And it was a place where kids could go, feel safe, and do their homework and all the rest of it. And then that turned into, you know, from after school to a youth center to a school, to a preschool. So, yeah, Harambe means let's get together and push.
Let's get together and push. Dr. Perkins is an incredible motivator and somebody who does bring a lot of people together to push many things, many good things. So you mentioned that first person you met there was Rudy, and then Derek Perkins. What did meeting those people mean to you?
I mean, they were just the first people that I met. You know, they were executive directors at the time of the center. You know, at the time I didn't know what meeting them would be. It just, over time, the relationships happen, conversations happen, you know, meeting their families, their lives, and learning how integrated family and ministry was, and the demands. And so I don't think there was an initial aha moment. It was more over time with getting to know them as people and the relationship.
So how would you describe your own life, like before Harambe, and then contrast it with what it was like after Harambe?
I mean, in night and day, but kind of not night and day. I mean, when you're working for a musician, you've got to, you know, dot your I's, cross your T's. You're doing all the stuff that needs to get them from A to B. But, you know, Harambe was working with kids. Sometimes, you know, when you're working with musicians, you are kind of working with kids. So the practical stuff wasn't different. The deep meaning stuff was very different. The Christ-centered stuff was absolutely night and day. And the longevity of what you were trying to do was very different. On one side, you was, you know, you were just getting an outcome. But on the other side of Harambe, you didn't know the outcome. You had to leave it to God and be a part of seeding whatever you were seeding. And the outcome was in God's hands.
So then you've said in the last 11 years, you've been leading an after-school program yourself in Pasadena. What's that experience been like? And what have you learned about yourself in the process?
I think the difference is, you know, when you're in a para ministry, which is Harambe, you know, you're learning to, you know, get support from donors, from churches, from foundations, all the rest of it. But when I chose to go on my own, I had to prove that I learned something. And the one thing was about relationships, and you bloom where you're planted. So if you can, you know, dig yourself deep into some place and, you know, and just figure out the earth of that place and let God water it in the relationships, then eventually, you know, God will see it. I mean, obviously there's hard days. You're doing everything by yourself. Harambe was a machine, so to speak. You know, you had staff, you had this, you had that, but it was still, you know, a small machine. But, you know, founding Thrive Learning Lab of Northwest Pasadena it was me. And slowly but surely, you know, getting staff, getting, you know, help from, you know, churches and people and organizations, you know, all come slowly and surely, but they all come out of relationships. They all come out of a conversation. They all come about God weaving something together to make what he's creating stronger. And that's what I've kind of learned over the 11 years, that it ain't about you. Whether, you know, if this is what God has called you to do, it really isn't about you. It's about people, property, and places which God cares about. And if you're in the right place where the people, property, and places are, God will see fit for you to bloom, prune, and grow again.
As you've made these movements, as these movements have happened in your life, who are some people that you've come to really admire? And what have been some of the contributions that they've made to what you think about and who you are?
I don't really know if it's the word is admire. I think the word is more that in the relationship they've challenged me to be better. They've challenged me to have different lenses. They've challenged me to be uncomfortable. I think that's a better way. You know, definitely Rudy and Coffee have challenged me when they were there and when they were afar to always go deeper and always understand that just because it looks like the end, it's not the end. It's just a very uncomfortable new beginning. And I think, gosh, there's a lot of people, you know, community and all the rest of it. But I hold back from actually admiring. I just, moreover, I give flowers to people who I see do the work in their own lanes. And the list is long. But yeah, there's, you know, people who do the work in their lanes and are very consistent in that work and in their lives is the ones I say I give flowers to for what they're doing.
Thinking a little bit more about a sense of reflection and purpose is, and coming back to your first story where you talked about that church sitting atop that the place where the slaves would depart from. What's your picture of God at the moment, and what's God teaching you about himself in these days?
I think that God is just mainly saying, very simply, he said, the first line in the Bible is, you know, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the last line in the Bible is that, you know, he leave the grace of Jesus Christ with us and people. So I see, you know, with us, you know, and community. And sandwiched between that is 66 books of highs and lows, you know, tunnels and dead ends. But that sandwich, but that first line and that last line is what, you know, God is really teaching, is that he created something for us to discover, to understand, not to destroy, but to take care of. But in the fickleness of man, he understood in his strategy and plans through 66 books that we were going to need. He couldn't be with us the way that he started. Mm-hmm. And so the end result was this grace that makes no sense, even to our foolishness, and that he would never leave us nor forsake us, because he was about community. He was about people. And in the middle of that, he gave us Christ, which wasn't to separate us from him, but was to draw us together. And I think somewhere, I mean, maybe in Revelation's early part, he says, you know, if I knock and you open, I will come in and break bread and be your friend. And I think in this season, it's about that, you know, God is really showing himself to be a friend, but not a pushy friend, not a demanding friend, but just a friend who pop up, knock on the door and be like, hey, come, can I come in? And, you know, you're like, yeah. And like, what you got to eat? Let's chop it up together. And in those conversations, you understand that there is love. You understand that there is healing. You understand that there's a restorative justice and peace. You understand that there's a joy. And the same way as when the two men who met Jesus on the road to Emmaus, you know, didn't know who he was, but once he broke that bread, they were enlightened. And I think that that's what it is. It's creating spaces for people to break bread with one another, listen to one another, be safe with one another, and hold each other in times and seasons that they can't hold themselves. And so I think that's what I see now, especially after COVID.
Mm-hmm. Well, if God shows up at your door and he says, hey, what's for dinner? What's for dinner at Flo's house?
I would have said.
Or in your community.
I would have said black eyed peas, but I went and burnt them yesterday. But, you know, it can be anything. It can be a sandwich. It can be, you know, a pizza. It can be a, you know, tamale in this season. It can be, you know, tacos. It can be rice and peas and chicken. It can be macaroni and cheese. It can be whatever it is that we will eat and see that the Lord is good. Taste and see that the Lord is good. And while we're, you know, learning how to be good to one another.
Would it ever be Jamaican oxtail soup?
Oh, absolutely. It's oxtails, it's all of that stuff. It's, you know, I think there's nothing, no culture or their food is above anything. It's breaking bread and, you know, eating food that crosses culture lines, that, yeah, you taste and see that the Lord is good.
Yeah. As you look out into the future, what are some things that have your attention, that are on your radar? What are some things that you're dreaming about, that you're passionate about, that maybe if you could do something, you know, without any kind of limitations, some things you'd like to accomplish?
I really don't know. I just, you know, I want to, you know, the after school to grow. You know, I want, you know, the kids to grow. I want, you know, obviously the resources and the stuff and the grants, the foundations, all of that stuff to grow and encompass more kids, especially in the summertime. I want the structure and the consistency, you know, to just, as I say, maintain and grow stronger. And, you know, more staff, more volunteers, all that great stuff. But I feel like when people ask that question of the future, I think that right about now, it's one day at a time. Right about now, it's probably 1 week, 1 month at a time. And yes, the Bible says, write the vision and make it plain. And I'm trying to figure out that the vision that I wrote is still having the same heartbeat, and, you know, and it's definitely necessary for community, and I know it is. So yeah, I don't know if I answered, but
no, that sense that you're, that's good, because you're giving us a picture, like in the place where you're living right now, what you're working on, that you see opportunities, and those opportunities, you're trying to leverage those to bring really the goodness of God in a manifest kind of way. So appreciate that. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to speak to? Tell us about yourself, anything.
No, I just think that, no, you know, I think that, you know, there's times people need to understand that when you start something or found something or do whatever it is in community, because I hold a lot of hats in community, is that leadership is lonely. But it's not lonely because sad. It's just lonely because you have to stand on decisions that sometimes don't get understood. You have to stand on decisions that are a little bit ahead of the future, and people have to catch up. And you have to stand on decisions that are your mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think that for that, but never alone. I think there's a difference of lonely and alone, because God said he'll never leave us nor forsake us. So if you're alone, then you've separated yourself from the God who loves. And that's our choice. That's something that we have to deal with, whether it's, you know, anger, depression, sadness, whatever it is. But, you know, lonely is just something that God can understand and can work with and bring you alongside people who will help you to erase that. And you know, break bread and iron sharpens iron and wisdom and friendships and all the rest. So yeah, that's it.
All right. I hear that you have a podcast of your own. Is that right?
Yes.
What's the name of your podcast?
It's Dena Council Community Update. So it's kind of bi-weekly, and it's goes out through Radio Honolera, and it's just whatever happens in council, maybe something that's happening in our community, that I put it out there, in conversation, no judgment, just this is what's going on. And let's think about it. Let's discuss it. And let's see if there's a solution among us to help. And so that's what it is.
And that's all about the Pasadena Council, City Council, right?
Yeah, it's about Pasadena City Council, what happens in council, major points, and what's happening in community. Sometimes, you know, if the council's not on, then something might be happening in community that we talk about.
Fantastic. Well, Florence, thanks for taking time to share your story, to share your life with us. You've been a significant partner with Schweitzer over the years, especially in our community impact ministries. And you've been a coach to a few folks around Schweitzer. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your life with us today.
Amen. Thank you for asking.
A big thank you to Florence for sharing her story. As we listen to Florence, I hope that you were inspired, encouraged, and challenged, that you might begin to behold the really cool people who are around you and that you might celebrate them. The Really Cool People podcast is produced by Schweitzer Church, Springfield, Missouri. Taylor Likes is our executive producer and editor, and I'm your host, Jason Leininger. You can help us by liking this, reviewing it, and sharing this podcast with people you think would find it helpful. Until next time, have a great day.